Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be back again, even though virtually at Perimeter. So today we'll talk about primordial black holes. So why primordial black holes? As you know very well, the LIGO-Virgo-Kaka collaboration has recently released the third catalog of gravitational events, in which about 80 events of coalescing black holes were detected. So it's timing to understand what is the physical origin behind these coalescing black holes. And of course, the most natural possibility is provided by astrophysical black holes that are formed in the very recent universe from the collapse of stars. But one may wonder if there are other possibilities, for example, black holes that may be formed after inflation in the very early universe, which we will call primordial black holes. So let's see the main differences between these two different objects. So astrophysical black holes are formed from the collapse of a star under gravity with a mass that is bigger than the Chandrasekhar mass, which is of the order of the solar masses or so. While primordial black holes may be formed in the very early universe from the collapse of large inhomogeneities, and they can span a much bigger range of masses, with a lower cutoff obtained by requiring that those primordial black holes are not evaporated until today due to Hawking radiation. Now, these two different formation scenarios will, of course, give rise to different predictions for the black hole masses, the black hole spin, and the merger rate, which is crucial to compare these populations with the data. So in this experiment of gravitational waves, all the information is captured by the gravitational waveform, which depends on many important parameters that are related to a binary, which is performing the merger. So at the leading order in the waveform, the most important parameter is the shape mass, which is a combination of the masses of the components of the binary under consideration. And then when you go at the next leading order in the positron expansion, you will find the mass ratio, which tells you the hierarchy between the two masses of the binary system, and the effective spin, which is basically a parameter that tells you the projection of the individual spins of the binary component projected onto the direction of the orbital angular momentum, L, as in the figure, and weighted by their masses. And going again in the positron expansion of the fifth positron order, there is also the log number, which captures the deformability of a given compact object under the presence of tidal perturbation. And I will come back on this topic at the end of my talk. So as I said before, of course, the different population will give rise to different predictions for these parameters. And the interest from the black hole also arise because on cosmological scales, they behave like a cold and collisionless fluid. So as such, they can represent a fraction of the dark matter in the universe. And in this very important plot, I'm showing on the vertical axis the PBH abundance in the universe normalized with dark matter one, with a parameter which is called FPBH, in terms of the mass of the primordial black hole that we are considering. Now, if FPBH may reach unity, it means that the primordial black hole with those masses can, in principle, comprise dark matter. But as you can see from the plot, there are many different observational constraints on the PBH abundance, depending on the masses one considers. For example, on the left, you can see the constraints which come from Hawking evaporation, and in particular on the product which primordial black holes may generate if they Hawking radiate. Then in this region here, you will see constraints coming from Michael Lansing searches. And finally, on the right, there are constraints from Planck data, and in particular from the possibility that primordial black hole experience a phase of accretion, which give rise to radiation signal that can impact on the CMB anisotropies, and which are constrained by Planck. And finally, there are constraints from the number of events which LIGO have seen so far, which basically tells that around this range, so 10 to 100 solar masses, primordial black holes cannot comprise the dark matter in the universe. However, there is still an open window from 10 to minus 11 to 10 to minus 16 solar masses, where there are no constraints up to now, and therefore in this region, primordial black holes are a viable candidate for the dark matter. And within my talk, I will try to discuss these two regimes and possible signals of gravitational waves which may connect them. So this was a motivation for my talk. Now I will discuss how primordial black holes may be formed in the very early universe and try to see if there are possible gravitational signals coming from their formation. And then I will discuss their evolution during the cosmic history. And finally, a possible signal coming from their collisions. So of course, if you have some questions, please feel free to interrupt me whenever you want. So let's start with PBH formation. So I will consider the most standard deformation scenario, which is where during inflation, one has an enhancement of the scalar cosmic computer perturbation on very small scales, which means scales much smaller than those proved by CMB observation. Now, during rating, this curvature perturbation is transferred to the radiation fluid. And when this perturbation in the radiation era re-enters the horizon, if they are large enough, they can collapse and create a primordial black hole. Now, such an enhancement in the curvature power spectrum can be achieved within different possibilities. But the most simple one is thanks to a violation of the standard slow roll condition of inflation, which can be achieved with an ultra slow roll phase of the inflaton potential, which is basically a region in which the inflaton potential is very, very flat. So the inflaton which rolls down along this region will basically decrease its velocity. And such a decrease in the velocity results in an increase of the curvature perturbation. And in particular, as you can see, those modes which exit the horizon during this phase will experience a super horizon growth, which is responsible for such an enhancement in the power spectrum. But of course, this is just one possibility. The main criterion for PBH formation is therefore that the density contrast of this perturbation in the radiation era is larger than a given threshold, delta C, which is found numerically thanks to a dedicated generativity simulation. And its value is found to be of order 0.5 or so, depending on the shape of the power spectrum which one considers. But the main message is that the mass of the primordial black hole will be of the order of the mass of the within the horizon at the moment of horizon crossing. Now, one of the most important properties of primordial black hole at formation in this scenario is the value of their initial spin. So we have just seen that primordial black holes form from maxima of the radiation over density field, which according to the standard peak theory by Bardeen et al, are mainly spherical. However, if there are some asphericities in this peak, basically the presence of surrounding perturbation around this may generate some torques on the collapsing peak. And this torque may be responsible for a final primordial black hole, which is spinning. However, during radiation domination, gravity is counterbalanced by radiation pressure, which makes the timescale of collapse very, very fast. And therefore, the action of these torques is quite limited in time, which implies that the initial primordial black hole spin is found to be below the percent level, so almost negligible. But this is a prediction of the scenario we are considering. One, of course, may ask if there are alternative scenarios for PBH formation. And two interesting possibilities are, for example, the formation during an early matte-dominated era before the heating, for example, driven by a scalar field. And what can happen is that perturbations during this phase will, of course, grow because we are in matter, and they can collapse and give rise to a primordial black hole. But there's also a possibility that those perturbations may accrete from the surrounding scalar field and give rise to primordial black hole, for example, onto possible boson stars, which may form during this phase. And the other possibility is instead given by first order phase transition. And in particular, the collision of the critical bubbles that are formed in the new phase may give rise to gravitational waves and primordial black holes once they collide, which of course is a very fascinating possibility to connect these two signals, so primordial black holes and gravitational waves. But there are many possibilities in the literature which I will not describe in my talk. So, having seen the formation of primordial black hole, let's see possible signals which come from this phase. And the most standard and most important one is provided by the generation of gravitational waves at second order in perturbation theory. So, if one writes down the Einstein equation for the tensor modes, basically one can see that those tensor modes are characterized by a source term which goes like the square of the gradient of the curvature perturbation, which for the case of primordial black holes are enhanced. So this implies that at the horizon crossing, there will be a strong source term in this equation, which is responsible for the generation of tensor modes at second order, and therefore a stochastic background which will propagate during the evolution of the universe and is possible detectable at present or future experiment. So one can, of course, compute the energy density associated with this stochastic background, which depends on the two-point correlation function of the tensor mode, which in turn depends on the four-point correlation function of the curvature perturbation. But a very nice feature is that one can relate the frequency of the gravitational wave, which is of the order of the frequency of the scalar perturbation, with the mass of the primordial black holes that are formed from the same scalar curvature perturbation. And the relation is the following. And in particular, if one looks at the range of masses where primordial black holes may comprise the dark matter, so for example, around 10 to the minus 12 solar masses, the formation of these objects will imply the generation of a stochastic background with a frequency which is around the millihertz, that is where the least experiment has its maximum sensitivity. So this implies that LISA can actually test the possibility of primordial black holes to be at least a fraction of the dark matter in the universe. So of course, this is one possible experiment which may look at this signal. And the other possibility is provided by NanoGrav, which is one of the famous pulsar timings array experiment. So these are experiments which look for the presence of pulsars that are spread around the heart. And these pulsars basically emit radio pulse with a period of the order of the millisecond, which are very well measured by at the Bessel detector. However, if there is a gravitational wave which is passing by this region with a frequency of the order of the nanohertz or so, this gravitational wave basically will induce some delays in the time of arrival of these radio pulses, from which one can try to understand the properties of the corresponding gravitational waves. In particular, one can correlate or can compute the cross correlation of the time residual of a given pair of pulsars, which depends on the angle between the two with the heart and on the strain and frequency of the gravitational wave signal. So one can try to determine the properties of this signal from this time residual. And in the latest 12.5 years data release, the NanoGrav collaboration actually claimed for a strong evidence for a stochastic process with a common amplitude and spectral slope across 45 pulsars. In particular, in this plot, you can see the time residual for these pulsars, which has a characteristic slope like this, around the nanohertz frequency, which may point toward the discovery of a stochastic background. And this kind of data basically reflects in some posteriors on the amplitude, the slope of the signal. So one possibility, and the most simple one, is provided by the collections of supermassive black holes, whose prediction falls very well within the posteriors found by the collaboration. But one may wonder if there are other possibilities, for example, in the VBH context. So one can explain this signal from gravitational waves coming from primordial black holes. Of course, the collaboration did not claim yet that this is a stochastic background, because there is no evidence yet for the quadrupolar Ellings and Down correlation pattern, which is basically a behavior of the angular correlation of the pulsars, which is needed in order to claim for a stochastic background discovery. So one has to wait for more data in order to claim a detection, and we have to wait for those data, but up to now, also other experiments of the pulsar timing arrays collaboration are finding the same stochastic process. So within our PBH scenario, we try to see with Gabriele Fancellini from Geneva and my supervisor Tony Riotto if there is a possibility that primordial black hole may explain such a signal from nanograv if confirmed. So what we considered was a standard ultrasonar phase in which you basically give rise to a power spectrum of the Hubbard perturbation, which is broad and flat. So basically it is enhanced and characterized by two given momentum scale, k short and k long, so long and short scale, which we have fixed by requiring the generation of a mass spectrum with boundaries around the 10 to minus 14 solar masses, where primordial black holes may comprise the dark matter, and around the solar mass range, which is responsible for the generation of gravitational waves around the nanohertz frequency. So what we did was to fix the amplitude of the power spectrum by requiring that those primordial black holes explain the dark matter in the universe. And in particular, the blue line in this plot shows the mass function of this PBH population in order for them to comprise the dark matter. So as I just told you, this dominant peak, which basically dominates the population, is the one in which primordial black holes give the strongest contribution to the dark matter. Then there are some scaling behaviors that are determined by the critical collapse and a rescaling of the energy density during the evolution of the universe. And then there is another peak around the solar mass range, which is due to the fact that during the QCD phase transition, there is a softening of the equation of state, which results in a lowering of the threshold for collapse and therefore an enhancement in the PBH production. So up to now, there is no connection to nanograv. What we did was just fixing the amplitude for PBH to be dark matter. And now, given that our model is fixed, we can see what is the prediction for the stochastic background. And the result is shown in the blue line of this plot, superimposed with many sensitivity curves of future experiment. So if we look at the frequency around the nanohertz, where is the nanograv posterior, as you can see, the abundance of gravitational waves created by this mechanism basically falls within the 90% competence interval, which means that this model can explain the nanograv signal if eventually confirmed. And then the shape of the power spectrum you have assumed basically results in a spectrum for the stochastic background, which is flat and propagates to larger frequencies around the LISA range. So in particular, we can see that our model can be detectable and tested by LISA. But of course, this is just one possibility. One can try to build up other models and see if this kind of result holds. So what we did was to create this kind of toy model which matches at the same time the dark matter and the nanograv signal. So with this, I conclude the second part of my talk, which is about the signals from formation. And now— and
just a quick question. SKA is how far in the future?
I don't know. I think we are talking about maybe 10 years, maybe more. I don't know, actually. I can check about that.
And the data that you showed for nanograv,
yes,
the one that they say there is no
the correlation. Yes,
this is with their full data set.
Yeah, this is for the 12.5 years data release, only for the analog collaboration. Then in the recent last year, also some data found by APTA, so the European PULSA timing arrays, which found something similar. So not yet a quadruple correlation pattern.
I mean, the data has a nice shape here. I say, but so yeah. I guess the 2-3 more years that you're saying is future data taking, or is this?
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, with more data, if the signal is confirmed, we should see something here.
But they haven't taken that data yet.
Not yet. Not yet. I think next year there will be the 15 years that are released, so maybe something may appear there. But it is still ongoing, so we have to wait a bit more.
Okay, got it.
Okay, so now let's move to the evolution of primordial black holes. So what we did was just describing their formation, but of course PBH will evolve during the cosmological history. So in particular, they will assemble in a binary system, which may experience a phase of accretion and eventually also give rise to a possible cluster. And of course, these phenomena are very important because they may modify the prediction of our model in order to compare it with the data. So let's discuss all of them. So I will start with the assembling binaries. So basically, we will consider the most standard scenario in which the curvature power spectrum follow a Gaussian distribution. So basically, primordial black hole follow a Poisson distribution at formation. So basically, they are discrete traces which are distributed according to a Poisson distribution. And what may happen is that a given two-body system, because of gravity, may decouple from the Hubble flow before the matter radiation equality and give rise to a binary system, which with time will evolve, emitting gravitational waves and finally merging. And the following expression describes the merger rate of the primordial black hole, which depends, of course, on the masses of the binary system you are considering, on the properties of the population, which is the mass function and the PBH abundance. Then it depends on a suppression factor, S, which takes into account the fact that this kind of binary can be destroyed by the presence of surrounding primordial black holes or from other dark matter perturbation, which of course will suppress the merger rate. And finally, there is dependence of time of this merger rate, which, as you can see, basically will grow with redshift, which means that the primordial black hole merger rate is expected to increase at larger redshift. Okay, so back in time. Now, the evolution will be straightforward if other phenomena do not play any role. But actually, we have seen that a possibility is provided by accretion.
Sorry, may I ask a question? Like, where does this power come from?
This one, the 34 over 37.
You have a bunch of them.
Yes. So basically, these powers are always dictated by the kind of dependence on the semi-measured axis and eccentricity that the primordial black hole distribution has at the formation. So how the eccentricity and semi-measured axis are distributed will impact then on the time, masses, and so.
So these are given analytically, or it's just fitted to some simulation?
No, this is, you have analytical predictions for the distribution of the semi-major axis and eccentricity, and then you can convert them in terms of time or masses and so, which give rise to these numbers.
Okay.
Sorry, can I sure. Also ask a bit about this? So there's the other formation of binary scenario that it's what Yassine did. You know what I'm talking about,
sure.
In the galaxy, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
And my understanding was that both these things gave similar answers accidentally, I guess. So what's the status of that?
Okay, now, so this is the prediction for the binaries, which are formed very early in the history of the universe. So, for example, around the matter radiation equality.
No, I understand that.
The other shell you are considering is the formation in the late universe. For example, you have a cluster, and within this cluster, a given pair of primordial black holes may be captured by each other and give rise to a binary. And in that case, the merger rate is different. So it's a different dependence of time, actually. That merger rate is, of course, limited to in the late universe. And also the dependence on the masses would be very different. So usually, the current status is that the early universe merger rate is the dominant one in giving rise to data, or at least in gravitational waves, which LIGO can observe. So this is the strongest contribution to the merger rate.
I see. Oh, that's surprising, because I remember like when LIGO came out and then Yassine wrote these papers, came out with this new formation mechanism or something. They were saying that the rates there were the dominant ones.
Developments have seen that actually is the opposite way around. So this is the dominant contribution. But there is an important point, which is the impact of clustering, on which I will come back after some slide. Because clustering may modify the merger rate. In particular, it will decrease the early binary merger rate, which is the one I'm showing in this slide, and actually may increase the late time merger rate. So also clustering is very important to see which of the two channels dominate. But even with the current understanding of clustering, this is the dominant contribution to the...
I see. And I guess related to that, so... And if you form binaries also in the late universe, just PBH binaries, so I guess that the rate of forming binaries with a star is significantly larger. Is that true?
Well, depending on the environment you are considering, right? So of course, it depends on the velocity with which the binary system will be formed there. And so you mean, for example, PBH with a star?
Yeah, I mean, just because if Yassine says that the PBH formation anyways, it's maybe subdominant to this, but important, I will naively expect that the PBH star formation rate will be just larger, just because there are lots of stars, especially mm-hmm. in the center of the galaxy.
Of course, that will then mean the strength of the merger rate also depends on the masses. So of course, if you consider a heavier primordial black hole, for example, in the paper you are thinking about, they were thinking still at LIGO Virgo. I think also that will be important to stress if the one rate is larger than the other. But I agree. I mean, in principle, depending on the environment, there may be other binaries which are formed in a more efficient way.
Okay.
Of course, that also depends on PBH abundance, because if it is very large, maybe it's easier to create a primordial black hole binaries instead of mixed binaries, let's say.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the question.
Can I also ask, so your merger rates presumably will depend, I guess, strongly on the relative angular momenta between these two binary black holes. Mm-hmm. And so how do you compute that?
Yes, so basically, in this subtraction factor S, it is taken into account, thanks to a numerical simulation, basically the presence of a third object, which basically prevents the head-on collision of the binary and of the two black holes, and is responsible for the generation of a binary. So in a recent paper, Rydal et al., basically what they did was exactly take into account the possibility that you have angular momentum provided by a third object. And this may, at the same time, enhance the production of the binary, but also suppress when the binaries are formed. So the information of the angular momentum is actually captured in this suppression factor S, which of course was found from this simulation.
Okay.
Also the dynamics of the eccentricity is captured by these powers I was talking about in replying to the other question. So let's say when you consider when they are formed, these binaries are very, very eccentric. And when then as the binary evolves, of course, a binary tends to circularize as it emits gravitational waves. So as you were saying, the momentum is very important because at the beginning they are very eccentric, so there is a large angular momentum. And in this factor S, one has to consider the presence of other objects which modify it.
But you're saying, though, that the generation of the angular momentum is dominated by some third object and not by like the larger scale, like curvature field.
No, exactly. I mean, in principle, if you have two black holes, they will try to collide head on because of gravity and basically just...
Except for like the large scale tidal field, right?
Well, I mean,
if there's some like larger scale tidal field acting on the two,
of course, yeah, I agree. Right, I agree, will... and yeah, exactly. Indeed, when I was talking about this S, there are contributions from the, say, a third from the black hole, or also maybe dark matter component in the case in which primordial black holes do not comprise the full dark matter. So I completely agree. And in that case, you are thinking about the contribution is captured by this S. So basically the picture is the following. In principle, you will have a head-on collision, but a third object or dark matter perturbation may induce a binary formation. Of course, that body may be destroyed and so on. It will be captured by other phenomena. But this is the picture, yes.
Okay. And so then to compute, I guess, this thing, like, you have to know, I guess, like the three-point function then for these three huge peaks. And so then, like, is the assumption, I guess, that this three-point function is then dominated by the Poisson piece?
Okay, so I think in this paper didn't go into this kind of computation. What we they see was just to consider a more homogeneous scenario. Of course, if you have a very large peak around those two, maybe the production of the binary will be maybe enhanced. So I think I agree, but. Of course, in our case, in this kind of assumption, primordial black holes are only distributed according to a Poisson distribution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, sure, okay. So the assumption is that all the endpoint functions are just dominated just by the Poisson term.
Yeah, for primordial black hole, yes. Then, of course, this assumption maybe changed. For example, if there are non-Gaussianities in the Kubota power spec, in the Kubota perturbation, like a local scaling bar non-Gaussianity, that will induce a crosstalk between large scale and small scale modes. Mm-hmm. And that will modify the standard assumption. In particular, primordial black holes will not be spatially distributed according to a Poisson, but they have a different distribution. Actually, there will be an initial clustering. And it is, of course, very important, as you were saying, because it enhances the production of binary. But at the same time, if you have many binaries close, they will merge earlier because they will be like if you have a cluster, you have more primordial black holes which are closer, and the merger will be enhanced. So there's this also effect to take into account.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but you're saying that in certain parameter regions, that that biased clustering can even exceed Poisson.
Of course, yes, this is what I'm saying. Okay. In case, of course, of a presence of a local Gaussianity, this is...
I see. So for large, I see, okay, great. Exactly. All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you for the question. Okay, so now let's go back to accretion. So as I was saying, basically, once a given binary is formed, it may accrete baryonic particles from the surrounding intergalactic medium. So of course, this process is very complex because there are many effects which one has to take into account. But what we did was to use the formalism developed by Bondi-Hoyle for the mass accretion rate, which depends on the total mass of the binary system, on the density of the medium from which one of the cores are accreting, on the velocity with which the binary will move within this medium, And finally, this accretion parameter lambda, which captures the dependence on the Hubble expansion, the gas viscosity, and the coupling to the SMB radiation. But the main message of this complex phenomenon is that primordial black holes, which are heavy enough, like larger than 10 to 20 solar masses, they may experience a phase of efficient accretion at redshifts smaller than 30. And actually, the smaller primordial black holes of the binary will always experience a larger relative accretion rate with respect to the primary component. And the reason is that the secondary component sees an accretion flow also due to the presence of the primary. Okay. But in this game, there's another player, which is eventually another dark matter component. So in particular, if primordial black holes do not account for the full dark matter in the universe, of course, there will be other dark matter component. And this component can create a halo around the primordial black hole, which will grow with time. And of course, this halo will be responsible in enhancing the mass accretion rate, because of course you have a heavier system which is accreting. So this effect has to be taken into account when studying accretion. So accretion, of course, will go on until one reaches the epoch of structure formation and reionization.
Can I ask something about that also? So yes. Why doesn't this form a disk? Why doesn't the interstellar gas form a disk around the PBH? Yes. Why do you bond the accrete and you run the accrete like more efficiently, like in a disk?
I will come back in 2 slides about that. Yes.
Okay, and sorry, and I guess you're also going to talk, I guess, about accretion in earlier times.
Yes, like radiation will, yes, okay. Yes. I mean, I will not talk about it, but as I was saying in the introduction, that is very important to set the constraints on the PBH abundance. Here, I'm following on late time accretion because it is the one which may modify the evolution of the binary system. But as you are saying, primordial black holes, which are in isolation at very early time, they may experience accretion, and that will be important for the constraints from Planck.
Okay.
Okay, so but we come back on the disk question in a second. So accretion will go on until we reach the epoch of structure formation and reionization, because at this epoch, there will be an increase of the temperature of the medium. And of course, the first structure will start to form. And primordial black hole may fall within this structure and experience an increase in their velocity, which of course will imply a decrease in the accretion's efficiency. Of course, this is very complicated and one needs to perform a simulation to account for all the feedback effect. But what we did was to try to capture these uncertainties, introducing a cutoff redshift, after which we neglect accretion. And we let this parameter to vary in order to account for these uncertainties. Now, let's see the predictions of accretion. So the first one is that if you have a given binary system, which is asymmetrical, as accretion takes place, the mass ratio of the system will grow towards unity. So asymmetrical binaries will tend to become symmetrical. And also, if you have a given PBH population, the heavier objects of the population will, of course, experience a stronger accretion, which will be responsible for the evolution of the mass function, which gets a tail at larger masses. And the spread of this tail will, of course, depend on the value of the cutoff redshift, because as the cutoff is smaller, it means that accretion will last a bit longer. So it will be a stronger effect on the masses, and the mass function will be further modified. But accretion is very important also for the spin. So as also we were suggesting, the accretion rate and the geometry of the accretion flow are actually highly connected. And in particular, the baryonic particles, which are falling, may carry a given angular momentum, which may be responsible for the generation of an accretion disk around the PBH. And if accretion is efficient enough, basically this will give rise to a transfer of angular momentum from the baryonic particles to the primordial black hole. which we modeled following the Jurassic model by Bardeen, thanks to which one can express the accretion rate in terms, the evolution of the spin in terms of the mass accretion rate. So basically the spins will evolve thanks to accretion. For example, in this plot, you can see the evolution of the spins of a given binary system, which at very large redshift are almost zero, as we are considering in our model. But as accretion takes place, the evolution of the masses will imply the evolution of the spins, which will reach extremality.
But you cannot redo this, right? Because you're assuming Bondi for the mass accretion rate, but now you're saying that there's a disk, but then the accretion is not Bondi anymore.
What we considered was the formula for the Bondi. I mean, this is... So in this expression here, of course, we're just considering the impact of accretion onto the system. But then, depending on the strength of accretion rate and the angular momentum carried by the particles, an accretion disk may form, of course, because there will be perturbations, no, that will induce a disk. So in particular,
But then the mass of your black hole will just shoot up because. I mean, once you have disk accretion, that M dot that you have there will just like be much, much larger than what you get from the M dot from Bondi, right?
No. Why do you say that? Depends.
Because disk accretion is more efficient, right?
I think it depends a lot on the strength of the accretion rate. So to create a disk, you basically have a condition on the angular momentum carried by the baryonic particles.
Right.
And then the geometry of the disk will depend on the strength of the accretion rate. In particular, you can create a thick accretion disk, a thin one or so.
Right.
And depending on the geometry of this disk, the efficiency of accretion will change. So for example...
Exactly.
So what we did was basically... we followed the paper by Ricotti of some 10 years ago, and in the paper he computed the M dot evolution, okay, and only for the values of M dot for which a thin accretion disk were satisfied, then for those values the spin may evolve. But as you were saying, if M dot is much larger than, for example, if the normalized M dot is much larger than unity, that will change the prediction for the accretion rate and for the spin also.
Yeah, but I guess I'm more familiar with accretion onto supermassive stuff. It's also thin disk accretion. And then the mass of supermassive black holes, they grow significantly, like several orders of magnitude, right?
Mm-hmm.
Due to thin disk accretion. So then I would have naively expected something along these lines here too, but your mass function are not really changing by orders of magnitude, right?
The masses can grow can grow sizably also in this case. I mean, now I don't know if you can see it well, but for example, this is a mass function in the green one, that is the one without accretion. So here we are jumping about orders of magnitude for the mass function.
But anyways, you're using Bondi to compute this one, but then you're using thin disk accretion to compute the spin up.
So we are always using the simulation by Ricotti, which is assuming this Bondi expression. But then to consider the evolution of the spin, we have to take into account also the geometry of the disk. But I agree with you in the sense that then the disk will change accretion. The accretion.
Exactly.
I completely agree. Yeah, of course, this is something which... we're not able to follow, of course. But I completely agree that in principle there will be a back reaction of the disk on the accretion efficiency.
Right.
I completely agree on that. So of course this is what we managed to do, but of course I agree that one has to maybe perform a simulation to see what is the real impact of the disk.
I see.
I think I'm missing something from this discussion. I mean, like my impression was that you're using like the Bondi rate to tell you the rate at which mass enters the disk. Like, is that not correct?
So we will consider in the Bondi expression to see how masses grow. And then
That's right. But the mass that's entering the black hole eventually will form some sort of disk. And exactly. The disk rate at which the disk is gaining mass, I thought that was set by the Bondi rate.
So I think the point of the other colleague was that when a disk is formed, that can back react on the efficiency with which you can compute the Bondi rate. So I think this was the point. So what
because we the did- Bondi radius, I thought, is like much larger than this disk radius, right? So then I don't see how the disk would affect the Bondi accretion.
You mean the sides of the disk compared to the sides of the Bondi radius?
Yeah.
Yeah, this I agree. In our scenario, of course, the depending on the velocity, of course, but we are considering, accretion starts to be relevant when the size of the Bondi radius is larger than the size of the binary. And of course, I think it's also larger than the disk which is forming. But maybe locally, this will also impact on the individual accretion rate. Even though at the sides of the Bondi radius, accretion is spherical. But then when you go at smaller distances, close to the radius of the black hole, maybe the disk may modify the accretion's efficiency. No, but at least this is what I think I try to understand from the other question. But this is a very complicated situation. It's not easy to take into account all the back reactions and feedback effect from occurring during accretion. So also the back reaction on the disk, I don't know what is its impact, but for sure at large distances is completely spherical. This I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you. We're saying that basically the spins of the individual components will grow. And this evolution can be used to make a prediction for the distribution of the effective spin parameter, which enters the gravitational waveform. In particular, the individual direction of the individual spins are uncorrelated with the direction of the angular momentum of the binary. And what happens is that if you consider small masses, the spin basically accretion is not relevant. So the spins do not evolve and the distribution is peaked around zero. But then as the masses basically grow, accretion is more relevant and the distribution spreads around zero with the transition point from spinning to no spinning, which depends on the cutoff. So of course, if the cutoff is smaller, accretion will last longer and there will be a stronger effect due to it. But the nice prediction of this model is that there is a correlation between the large values of the masses and large values of the spin and vice versa, which is a feature of the accretion we are considering, of course. And this can be used maybe to disentangle the PBH scenario from astrophysical one. Okay, so this concludes the part of accretion. So finally, let me go to the discuss of clustering. Because after the matter radiation equality, primordial black holes, if they're abundant enough, may give rise to clusters. So in particular, there was a fantastic simulation by Imad Aliamud some years ago, in which they found that for very large VBH abundances, some clusters will form. And these clusters are very important because within them, there will be many binary interactions, which may modify, of course, the eccentricity and the same major axis of the binary we are considering. And the bottom result is that the early time merger rate may be suppressed when clustering is taken into account, but only for very large abundances. For a smaller one, and actually this is the range we are considering for LIGO Virgo, clustering is not relevant. Okay. So this concludes the third part of my talk. And now I will discuss the signals coming from PBH collections. So as I told you during the introduction, the LIGO-Virgo collaboration released the second and third catalog in the past years. with about 80 events or so of collection black holes. So in the catalog, there was evidence for spinning events and also for some events in the astrophysical mass gap, on which I will come back in a couple of slides. But the main message is that already some features start to appear in the distribution of the data. So the first question we tried to ask was if primordial black hole alone within our model could reproduce all the features which appear from data. And actually the answer to this question is no. So as you can see in this plot, which is found from an analysis of the PBH model we considered with the data, the blue line is the best fit distribution for the primary mass, which we found, and the red one is the one found by the collaboration. And as you can see, there are differences both at smaller and large masses. So the next step we tried to do recently was to add possible astrophysical channels, which combined with primordial black holes may best fit data better than the single population scenario. So we consider possible astrophysical formation channels. For example, there are the dynamical one, so formation of binaries in globular cluster or nuclear star cluster, or also the formation in galactic nuclei thanks to a common envelope phase. So the analysis is very complex, and the role of primordial black holes within the catalog will strongly depend on the channels one considers. So depending on the channel one considers, the answer of their presence or not will depend on it. But they are competitive with some of the astrophysical channels we considered. And the main message, the most important one, is that the number of events which LIGO found set a constraint on the abundance of primordial black hole to be smaller than 10 to minus 3 or so, which means that in order not to overproduce primordial black holes and to overproduce the data, the PBH abundance has to be smaller than this value. So in order to claim the presence of primordial black holes or not in the data, one has to keep into account all the uncertainties in both the primordial and astrophysical channels, which are many, and also include additional astrophysical channels to see their relative role. But a very nice feature of this comparison comes from the mass gap event. So if one considers astrophysical population, there is a prediction for the astrophysical mass gap. So basically, during the evolution of a star, there will be, if it is very heavy enough, there will be a production of electron-positron pairs within the star that induce a collapse of the star. Then there will be the burning of the very heavy elements within the star that induces what is called pulsational peristability, with which the star will basically eject material. And finally, the resulting black hole is expected to be lighter than about 50 solar masses, or eventually heavier than 130 solar masses if this process is avoided because of a very large initial mass. So there is this gap in the astrophysical population, which however is not present for primordial black holes, which experience a different collapse and therefore they may span the full range. And in particular, in the second catalog, there was an interesting event, which is GW19-0521, in which at least one of the components has a mass in the mass gap. So these are the best fit values which the collaboration found. So what we asked for was to see if primordial black holes can explain these events and also match their rate. And the result is actually yes. So in particular, events of this kind are expected from PBH population with a rate which is compatible with observation. So this is very important also to disentangle primordial black holes from astrophysical one. So this concludes the comparison with the present data. And now we can ask what is the prediction for future experiment. So in the next year, 10, 20 years, some new experiment will be prepared. So in particular, there will be LISA, which is able to measure black hole collisions is up to 10 to minus 10 to the 9 solar masses, and also 3G detectors like Einstein Telescope and Cosmic Explorer, which will be able to go even to the subsolar range. And both of them actually will be able to measure merger events at very large redshift. So all these three possibilities point in the direction of trying to distinguish primordial black holes from astrophysical one. And now in the next slide, I will try to go through all of them and see how we can use future experiment to disentangle the two populations. So as I was saying, the first one is the merger at very high redshift. And the reason is that, as we have seen in the during the discussion, the PBH merger rate is found to increase with the redshift. So we expect the collisions of primordial black holes at very large redshift. However, from the astrophysical side, this does not happen. In particular, the merger rate is expected to peak around redshift of order 2 or 3. And at most, there will be a contribution from population 3 stars, which may shift this, create another peak at larger redshift. However, for redshift above 30, let's say, primordial black holes are the only source we may expect this experiment. And in particular, within our analysis, we found that Einstein Telescope, for example, is expected to measure at least 1,000 events per year at very large redshift, so larger than 30, where there will be no contamination from astrophysical one. So this is very important because maybe may point towards primordial black hole discovery. So this is the first possibility. And the second one is to look for subsolar objects. And on this point, very interesting systems are extreme mass selection spiral, which are a system in which a light component, which may be a primordial black hole with a subsolar mass, basically orbits around a central supermassive or intermediate mass black hole. And this system may be detected both at LISA and Einstein Telescope, as you can see from this plot where I'm showing the signal to noise ratio. And in particular, both of them can actually detect primordial black in subsolar objects, so masses below 0.1 solar masses or so, reaching distances about 500 megaparsec for LISA or order gigaparsec for Einstein Telescope. So why these systems are interesting? And the reason is that if you are able to detect this system, you will be able to measure the mass of the lighter component of the binary with an extremely high precision. So one can compute a Fisher analysis and see that at 5 sigma confidence interval, one could be able to exclude a mass which is larger than the solar masses. So basically, both experiments, so both LISA and Einstein Telescope with different range of masses, if they detect an embryo of this kind, they can measure very well the mass of the light component. And this would be very important to claim for a subsolar detection. And actually, for Einstein Telescope, it's also a novel result because LIGO Virgo actually is not able to measure this kind of system.
So maybe I missed it, but how do you compute the PBH embry rate?
Yeah, okay. Now in this kind of analysis, so we didn't include the rate information. This is just saying if you measure an embry, what is the signal to noise ratio to measure it and the error on the masses. I completely agree that the information of the merger rate is crucial to see how many embryos we can detect. And there are many uncertainties on this computation because it depends a lot on the kind of formation scenarios one considers, which for supermassive black hole is not easy to compute. So I agree that
But I guess within the radius of influence of the supermassive black hole, that's, I don't know, like it's like 100 milliparsecs or something like that, or a parsec. I guess that there's very little dark matter, right? So, I mean, usually embryos, they start from the radius of influence of the black hole and then they start in spiraling. Mm-hmm. But for usual embryos, you have baryonic stuff there, right? But yes, here, I guess there's very little dark matter there. Is that true? Yeah, or
I agree. So for what I know, a recent paper which tries to compute the merger rate of M-RIS and primordial black hole is read by Chen et al. Of 4 years ago, in which they claim that if an abundance of primordial black hole of the order of 10 to minus 2 to minus 3, you can expect one event every 4 years at LISA. But they made a computation making some assumption on the number density of primordial black holes in a given environment and how a system of this kind is assembled. So I agree that this is still very uncertain. I mean, I agree that in principle, the rate will not be so large. But the point is that even though you detect at least one system of this kind, then you can measure incredibly well the mass of the component and maybe claim for the detection. This is the point of which I'm making. But I agree that the rate is very important and additional studies have to be performed to compute it in this kind of setting, at least.
Can I ask about this? I mean, so you're saying that from the Emery waveform, we can measure the component masses really well. Mm-hmm. My impression from a few years ago, was that we still don't know how to compute the waveforms for these Emerys. Like, has that changed?
So what we consider were the, I completely agree on this point. So there is still a lot of work to do in order to characterize better the waveforms for Emerys. What we did was to consider the most recent result of them. I think, for example, they are similar to the wave AKE waveform, but I agree that there is still ongoing work in trying to provide the waveform which are better suited for Emerys. Okay, this is, in this analysis, so we use the current waveforms for example, similar to the AKE, but I agree that there is still some work to do to provide the better waveforms for this system.
Oh, okay. If you don't mind, question. So the masses that I see on your plot here, they seem to coincide with the masses of stars and brown dwarfs.
This is
important. Those exist. We know they exist. If I saw this, why wouldn't I just think that I saw some brown dwarf?
Fantastic. So this is a very important point. And actually, the reason relies on the tidal disruption. So if you have a system with such a mass and the component is a white dwarf, for example, before you reach the Isco radius, the white dwarf will be destroyed by the tidal effects. So you can compute the Roche radius for this kind of system. And you will see that before reaching the Isco, the system will be destroyed. But primordial black holes do not experience this kind of tidal effects because their log number is zero. So you can actually say they may be primordial black holes and not white dwarf. Of course, there are other possible explanations. For example, there are dark sectors in which you can build up some models that will give rise to subsolar objects which are not deformable. And I agree that in principle, those can be confused with primordial black holes. But at least for a white dwarf, the situation is clear. So tidal effects will destroy them before you reach this point.
Okay, great.
Sorry. But so for a white dwarf, the Hills mass of a supermassive black hole is 10 to the 6 solar masses or 10 to the 5 solar masses, right? Mm-hmm. So actually for white dwarfs, there's no tidal disruption. The white dwarf gets swallowed. Right? Just because the Hills mass is... Yeah, so there are no tidal disruption of white dwarfs in supermassive black holes with masses larger than 10 to the 6, if I remember correctly.
So... brown dwarf for sure they will be destroyed.
But also it's not really like that, right? Because so the tidal radius, it's a measure on an encounter of a star that is extremely eccentric. So it's essentially a head-on collision into a black hole and you just get disrupted. But an Embry, it's like, it's literally a circle that is very, very closely approaching the supermassive black hole. So what naively what we'll expect that will happen is that it will strip down the surface of the star, and then the star will keep spiraling in. You see, I mean, a tidal disruption event, it's very, very different than what you are considering, which is an Embry. An Embry is a circular trajectory. A tidal disruption event is an elliptical trajectory. So it's a thing that it's in a circular trajectory and approaches the black hole by gravitational wave emission.
But for example, in gravitational capture, you can give rise to eccentric binary, no? Actually, this is usually the strongest prediction is that when you have a gravitational capture, so to system which gets very close and emission gravitational waves which give rise to a binary, in that case, the same major axis, there's a large eccentricity, no?
But by the time you see it at LISA, by the time that you see it at LISA, I thought that the trajectory was already circular because just it circularizes. Isn't that true?
I don't know, because these are systems which may be formed in the very late universe. It's not, I don't know, not so sure that they will circularize so fastly. But also in that case, the effect of tidal disruption will still be present, no? Even though they are
circular. But what happens if you have like a circular trajectory that approaches supermassive black hole is not that you tidal disrupt the star, you just disrupt the surface of the star because the approach is so slow that you very, very slowly strip out gas from the star. You don't really break the star at once. You see, it's just very different.
I see. So I didn't know about this comment, but my understanding was that this kind of binary system would be formed eventually with a high eccentricity because of gravitational capture. But maybe you can give rise to other system in which you may have a circular object orbit.
I'm not entirely sure if it's circular by the time that LISA gets there. Most of these things are higher angular momentum objects, but my understanding was that by the time that you get by LISA, it's already circular because it's circularized. But I'm not sure, actually.
Yeah, I don't know, because I was thinking about the standard gravitational capture, and for sure, for that kind of mechanism, at the beginning, at least, the binary would be super eccentric. But probably one has to compute. I mean, in that case, the merger rate enters because you can estimate what is the efficiency with which a binary will evolve and circularize, and then see if at least it is still eccentric or not. This is, I think, something which still has to be done.
Okay.
But thank you for the other comment. I didn't know about this in the case of circular binaries that only the exterior part will be destroyed. But another point, this, of course, effect is very important close to the ISCO radius. And at a certain point, even though in the first cycles, you will destroy the outer part of the star, but at a certain point, when it'll be very close, you will still destroy it completely, no? I mean, the brush radius, which takes into account this, will of course be is larger than the ISCO. So in any case, you will destroy it at a certain point.
I'm not sure, but in many cases, the tidal radius, which is the Roche radius, it's within the horizon of the supermassive black hole, and the star just gets swallowed. So that's what happens literally for white dwarfs, for instance. They get swallowed. They don't get tidally disrupted in black holes with masses less than 10 to the, more than 10 to the 6 solar masses, just because the tidal radius is within the horizon.
I see.
But it's more complicated than I think. I will naively expect that it's more complicated than just naive tidal disruption.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you. Thank you, sir, for your point. Yeah. But for example,
It is possible, that the Love number might be large enough that the waveform would be different, right? You know, for these dwarf stars compared to
that's for sure.
It's possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
Sorry to crash the party, but I suggest to kind of get to conclusions and then we stop recording and we can discuss after.
Sure. Just a couple of slides and then we'll close. Yeah. Okay, so we'll come back on this point later. So talking about actually Love number, this is the final part of my talk. So as I was saying during the introduction, log number captures the deformability of a given compact object under the presence of external tidal fields. And it depends on the internal properties of the object the one considers. And it is found to give an imprint in the gravitational signal, the fifth possible Lorentz order. Now, for neutron star or black holes, there have been many, many works computing the log number. In particular, for binary star, it has found that the measure of the log number will provide information on the neutron star equation of state. While for black holes, the log number are zero. Of course, one can ask if one considers a different setup. For example, black hole, which are surrounded by matter fields. So what we would call dressed black hole. And for example, what we consider in the PVH scenario was a primordial black hole surrounded by a dark halo. So what we did in a recent paper was to compute the tidal log number for dressed black hole, in which the dress was obtained by, for example, accretion of a scalar field onto the black hole, or thanks to superradiance, which is a mechanism for which an ultralight bosonic scalar field may extract rotational energy from the spinning black hole and give rise to a cloud. So we computed the log number, which depends on the mass of the black hole and on the mass of the scalar field under consideration. And then we try to investigate the detectability of this log number at both Einstein Telescope and LISA in order to transfer this information to the mass of the scalar field under consideration. So the main points of this analysis were that LISA is able to measure the log number of dressed black hole spanning from the stellar mass to the supermass range. And actually, the two experiments together may probe a range for the ultralight bosonic mass, which goes from 10 to minus 11 to 10 to minus 17 electron volt. And of course, the next point is to investigate, for example, the role of accretion disk in the log number and see their impact on the waveform, which of course would be very important also for primordial black holes in the accretion model we considered before. So given time, let me give the conclusions. So primordial black holes are fascinating objects which may be formed in the early universe, and they provide one of the possible candidates of the dark matter. They can be produced within different formation scenarios, and their formation can be tested by, for example, LISA or nanograb experiments. And they are competitive with the current astrophysical models and still may contribute to the present catalog found by the LIGO-Vigo-Kaga collaboration. And finally, future experiments like LISA or 3G detectors may actually help in discovering primordial black holes and finding additional properties of these objects if they exist. So with this, I thank you for your time, and I'll be happy to answer other questions if there are.
All right, thank you, Valerio. Here's some virtual applause. Are there any other questions people want to discuss? So the issues that appear during the talk? Or... Okay, given the time, I suggest we thank Valerio again.